Writer Laura Silver felt an unrecognizable void when her grandmother died. A few years later, a second emotional punch came. The bakery, where her grandmother used to take her to buy fresh knishes, closed its doors. Mrs. Stahl's, as it was called, was a New York institution. Generations of families had relied on it for its knishes, those savory pastries Eastern European immigrants brought to America in the early 1900s. So Laura Silver set off on a quest to find out why her family's favorite knish place was closing, which turned into a project about the history of these baked delicacies and what it means to the people who love them. Laura Silver joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get any further, I think we need you to describe in your own words what a knish is and when are they at their best and worst, for that matter.
Wow, good question. A knish is a pillow of dough that's filled with mashed potatoes, and I believe that a knish is best served hot, piping hot, aromatic, that scent of onions and baked dough just wafting through the air, and probably at its less best when it's cold.
The cold knish cannot be redeemed.
Well, with a little heat, it can be fixed up a bit.
And so what was that like, the moment when you realized that this knishery, is that a word, a knishery?
Yes, it certainly
is.
Is
it? Wow. Yeah.
With a Y. I'd put a Y at the end.
that this legendary knishery was closing. You didn't take this so well.
It was in November, I remember, kind of a cold day, and I biked to Brighton Beach, and I got there so eager for a knish, and I saw these plastic flags outside the shop, and those are the plastic flags that signal a grand opening. And for me, it was a grand closing. Mrs. Stahl's for 70 years stood beneath the elevated subway, and on that day, I found out it had become a subway sandwich shop.
So you decide to use this as an opportunity to trace the history of the knish, with a special focus on its history in New York. And as part of that, in the book, you profile several knish makers. Can you tell us about Ruby Oshinsky?
Yes. Well, Ruby the knish man was a man who sold knishes that were called mom's knishes, oddly. And he was known for bringing his knishes around in a metal cart to schools in parts of Brooklyn. In the summers, Ruby went to the Catskills, and he sold his knishes out of a van and a truck, a kind of a car that he styled with an oven, in a heating oven, in the trunk. This was his own invention, and so strong is the Ruby lore that a woman named Bonnie Abrams wrote a song about him called Ruby's Knishes.
I want to sing of Ruby's Knishes. It's been one of my fondest wishes to taste the potato and the kasha I ate when I was a clean and ashe. Now if you don't know what
You also tell the story in the book about another knish legend. Her name was Gussie Schwabel. Who was she?
Well, Gussie Schwabel was a woman who had a knish shop on Houston Street, not too far from where Yonah Schimmel's knish shop stands today. And she's someone who wanted to serve her country. She was an immigrant, and she wanted to serve her country by serving knishes to the armed forces. And she sent her suggestion to none other than Eleanor Roosevelt. And Mrs. Schwabel also wanted Eleanor Roosevelt to taste these handmade knishes.
She was very bold.
No kidding. she was a great PR agent for herself. She took an article in which she had been mentioned and she sent it to the First Lady. And lo and behold, she was invited to deliver knishes to Eleanor Roosevelt's Upper East Side apartment. However, there was a snafu. It was written about in the morning paper. So many people got excited, and apparently there were throngs gathered there, so many throngs.
To witness the delivery of the knishes.
Yes. To witness the first ever knish delivery to a first lady.
So what is the state of the knish now? You write that it is taking hold in younger generations of food types who are trying to revive it?
Yeah, I do believe it is. The knish is entered hipster lingo. It's available in many places across the country and even the world. And there's a guy in New York who started his own knish business on the Lower East Side. It's called Knishery NYC. And I do believe a knish renaissance is about to take hold.
Laura Silver, her new book is called Knish, In Search of the Jewish Soul Food. She joined us from her studios in New York. Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now, when Allied troops broke out from the Normandy beaches in 1944 and liberated Paris, there is no doubt that some celebrated with a bottle of wine or two. France is a nation of wine lovers. The United States has not always been so, but in recent years, more Americans sip a glass of wine with dinner, and wines with a lower alcohol content are catching a bigger share of the market. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
A few months back, before any of us were thinking about barbecues, I happened to be talking to Andrew Waterhouse. He's a professor at UC Davis who studies wine chemistry. And he told me a story about how his wife had picked up an inexpensive bottle of French red from Trader Joe's one night.
Cost $6. And she said, well, let's try it. We're having chili, so we'll try this red wine.
His expectations were low, given the price, and he says the first sip was a little underwhelming.
So here's what happened. At the end of the evening, the bottle was empty.
Waterhouse says the wine was not bold or fruity. It was much more subtle. And he says it kind of grew on them.
It had acidity, so it complemented the food really well. And one of the effects I noticed was I wasn't feeling the alcohol. And I thought, wow.
When he inspected the label, he saw the wine had only 11% alcohol. That's significantly lower than typical California reds, which in recent years pushed into the 14% range. And he says as he's looked into it further, these lower alcohol wines, especially white wines, are turning up everywhere.
We're seeing more requests for more balanced, lighter-bodied, lower-alcohol wines.
That's sommelier Devin Broglie of Whole Foods. He says from sparkling Italian Proseccos to Rieslings and Moscatos, many of these lighter wines are trending. And lots of factors influence alcohol levels. The type of grapes used, the climate where they're grown, and winemakers have several techniques to manipulate alcohol levels. They can halt the conversion of sugar to alcohol in the bottle, and they can adjust how long the grapes stay on the vine.
Lower alcohol is indicative of the grapes were picked at not overripe, but maybe just ripe.
He says after years of winemakers pushing the envelope to produce very ripe, sugary grapes that make bold, hit-you-over-the-head wines, the tide has turned.
Now we're just seeing, I think, a natural trend the other direction towards more subtlety in wines, which I see it gaining momentum.
Good afternoon, Tenley Town shoppers. I wanted to let you know about a great wine tasting that we're starting back in our prepared foods area.
Take, for instance, some of the top-selling wines being sampled at this Whole Foods in Washington, D.C.
So the first wine we have is the Vino Verde, which comes from Portugal.
As wine buyer Anthony Riker pours samples, he explains Vino Verde, which translates as green wine or young wine, is made from grapes that don't get very ripe.
And it's just a nice, refreshing white wine. Got a little bit of effervescence to it.
A few shoppers who've gathered around, Ellen Siegel and Simone Andrew, give the Vino Verde a try.
I like this one a lot.
Oh, good. Very refreshing.
How would you describe it?
It's pretty good. It's got a little bit of bubble to it. Kind of reminds me of champagne.
And Stacey Graham tries it too.
I thought that was refreshing. I think it would be good for backyard drinking, maybe with a barbecue.
She's surprised when I point out to her that the wine's alcohol content is just 9%. Typical Chardonnay hovers around 14%.
Does that make it any more or less appealing to you that it has less alcohol?
It makes it more appealing, I think.
Why is that?
I think I wouldn't get tired after having two glasses. I could enjoy it without worrying that I won't be able to take care of my kids if they're running around in the backyard and I need to start doing stuff with them.
And another surprise, the price. Many of these Vino Verdes and other lower alcohol wines retail in the $8 to $10 range. One reason, winemakers spend less time ripening and fussing over the grapes. And many of these wines are made to be drunk young. This also lowers costs.
I think a lot of times when you have a cheaper wine, something under $10, you know it's cheap. You know, you can drink it, it's passable, but this is more enjoyable. I thought it was very good.
And more winemakers are betting that the mix of affordability and a lighter, more refreshing style is a winning combination. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Next, we have the results of an investigation. The project we call Hidden Kitchens reports on counterfeit wine. Selling plain old wine as some special vintage is a lucrative form of fraud targeting some very wealthy collectors.
And now the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, introduce us to some unique detectives. They specialize in verifying vintage wines.
Our story starts with a French physicist working a mile underground. He's testing wine for signs of radioactivity, which would suggest it was made after the first atomic bombs were detonated.
I take the bottle in the hand. I put the bottle close to the detector. Then I close the shielding, and we start to record the gamma rays we are looking for, radioactivity, in the wine. Most of the time, the collectors send me bottles of wine because they want to know if it is fake or not.
I use razor blades, magnifying glasses, flashlights, blue light. A lot of wine labels will fluoresce under a blue light. My name is Maureen Downey, wine detective. Counterfeit wines have become a much bigger problem of late. In the last year, I myself have written reports for about $5 million worth of fakes.
Fraudsters put a lot of work into trying to make their corks look distressed. It's important that the label looks as though it's been around the block a bit, and so they might rub it with a bit of earth or coffee grounds.
There are two ways to counterfeit wine. You're either messing with what's in the bottle, or you're messing with the bottle itself. My name is Patrick Radden Keefe. I'm a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. I wrote a story called The Jefferson Bottles.
At Christie's Wine Department, it is our mission to bring the very best of wine from around the world to you and your wine cellar.
In 1985, there was a wine auction at Christie's in London at which they auctioned a bottle of Lafite, one of the finest vineyards in France. It was a very old bottle inscribed in a spindly hand with 1787 Lafite and the letters THJ. Christie said that evidence suggested that this bottle came from a collection of old French wines which had belonged to Thomas Jefferson. That bottle sold for $157,000 to the collector Malcolm Forbes, the most expensive bottle of wine ever sold at auction. At the time, he said, "It's more fun than the opera glasses Lincoln was holding when he was shot, and we have those too." Wine collectors jockeyed to get a hold of other Jefferson bottles from this mysterious collection. One of these collectors was Bill Koch. His brothers are often known as the Koch brothers. Bill Koch purchased four of these bottles in the late 1980s for about $500,000.
I'm Lucia Stanton. I was senior historian at Monticello for over 30 years. All of us at Monticello at that time were very skeptical about any connection between Jefferson and these wine bottles. Jefferson carefully had the wines that he had purchased in France shipped to this country for himself and President George Washington. In his vast records, over 60,000 documents, there was nothing that suggested that Jefferson had ever ordered any of these wines. There were about a dozen bottles, 1784 and 87, Chateau de Cam, 1787 Lafitte, Amargo. Most of them were 1787s, which is a vintage Jefferson never ordered in his life.
When Koch realized that he had potentially been crossed, he has Jim Elroy, a former FBI agent, kind of genial bloodhound of a guy. He said to Elroy, "Saddle up," and Elroy did.
My name is Jim Elroy, retired special agent with the FBI.
The ringtone on Elroy's phone is the whistled theme to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
I've identified the perpetrator as a guy by the name of Hardy Rodenstock. Actually, his true name was Meanheart Gorky.
Hardy, I met quite a few times. He was a great fixture on the European fine wine circuit. I'm Jancis Robinson. I write about wine for jancisrobinson.com and for the Financial Times. Hardy supposedly found the Jefferson bottles in a bricked-up cellar in Paris, but he couldn't give any more details. He was never specific about exactly how many bottles there were.
Jim Elroy had a hunch that the wine in the Jefferson bottles did not date to the 18th century.
I started looking in Scientific American, and I found an article that Philippe Huberd, a French physicist, had written about using low-level gamma ray detection for cesium 137 to date wine. Cesium 137 did not exist on this planet until we exploded the first atomic devices.
The cesium radioactivity we find in the wines reflect exactly the history of the atomic age. I'm Philippe Huberd, physicist working at the University of Bordeaux. First, you had development of the nuclear bomb, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. And then in the 50s or the 60s, the Cold War between US and Soviet and nuclear atmospheric test. And then in 1986, Chernobyl accident, which released a lot of cesium activity in the atmosphere.
The Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant has detected a record level of radioactive cesium in groundwater.
This radioactivity, it's everywhere, everywhere. Then with the rain, this radioactivity pours on the grapes. When you make the wine, this comes into the wine and stays into the wine. If I see cesium in a bottle of, let's say, 1900, it is sure that it is a fake.
The feds have put a cork in a vintage crime with the conviction of wine whiz Rudy Kernighawan, a connoisseur of counterfeiting who mastered label making, cork stamping.
Counterfeiting wine is not new. King Louis XIV had a royal decree that all of the wine barrels coming from the Côte du Rhône area had to be stamped CDR to prove that they were Côte du Rhône. The Thomas Jefferson bottles, Bill Koch's investigators found the people in Germany who engraved the T and the J into the bottle using modern dentist tools that could not possibly have existed in the time of Thomas Jefferson. One expert likens it to Abraham Lincoln holding an iPhone. When you've got Abraham Lincoln in a photograph holding an iPhone, we've got a problem.
One of those truisms of wine detection. The story was produced by the Kitchen Sisters and Jim McKee. You can inspect the Jefferson bottles for yourself and meet the physicist who tested them at npr.org.